The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the first in our live Guardian Tech Weekly events at Imperial College, the Tech City Talks. Now, this series unpicks the biggest issues in the UK's technology industry in advance of the first anniversary of David Cameron's launch of the Tech City proposition. Now, the Tech City proposition is an initiative spearheaded by the government to focus attention on the East London digital startup scene. But behind the headlines, there are some more substantial elements of the digital economy that we feel need to be investigated. And in this series, we tackle net neutrality and e-citizenship, enterprise and innovation clusters, and intellectual property and ownership in the internet age. Tonight's talk, however, looks at a more pragmatic issue: who will build the digital economy? Does the UK have the skill force to build the next Facebook and Google? If not, what needs to be done to ensure that our position in the global marketplace remains where it is? And should we be looking at the relationship between Stanford University and Silicon Valley for the answers? Joining the debate are the big thinkers, policymakers, and the people at the coalface, as well as the Tech Weekly audience and listeners. Thank you very much. We're pleased to welcome on the panel David Willetts, MP, the Minister of State for Universities and Science. David Willetts, you've been involved in policy decisions for the skills space for quite a number of years now. As far as I'm aware, you were in the shadow cabinet as the Department of Education and Skills Minister and looking at trade and skills. What would you say, in your opinion, having had at least a decade in this space, been an exemplary political initiative in the age of computers that's really got kids involved in technology?
Well, I think there's a couple. Of course, these are not simply government initiatives. The whole point about this sector is that it's very enterprising and individualistic, and it's not sort of doing things because government requires it. But one thing that I've been very keen on is Apps for Good, which is a competition run by a social enterprise for trying to get kids to think about new apps they'd like for their mobile phones, and then helps them to understand how those apps might actually be written. And I had the privilege the other week of giving a prize to the teenage girl in East London who had won one of the Apps for Good competitions. And that's great, and that helps people to realise they can use IT creatively. And the second initiative, very similar, behind the screen, is an attempt to break down the problem, for which I think successive governments are responsible, of treating education in IT as if you are just educating consumers in using IT and losing sight of the need to train young people as well, to give them the opportunity of being creators who help write software and generate products. And behind the screen is an initiative led by several businesses that are very worried about this. They came to see me to talk about it months ago, where essentially they're going to try to trial a different type of GCSE leading to a different type of A-level, which will be not in consuming IT, but generating it.
Well, we'll be picking that apart a little bit later on. Joining us as well is Jeff McGee, the principal of the Faculty of Engineering here at Imperial College. Now, Jeff, you're also, as well as being closely involved with academia and the development of the course load here at Imperial, you're an important liaison between the ivory tower and industry. How do you do that? Which companies have you worked with?
So I'm principal of the Faculty of Engineering, as you've said, and I was previously head of the Department of Computing. And for this debate, I think the experiences with respect to the Department of Computing are perhaps most relevant. And there we formed an industrial liaison club where we actually get industry involved in advising us what we should be doing in the syllabus and the sort of students they want. And so, for example, we've had major industry players such as IBM, Google, HP. We've had startups such as Mind Candy, and also users of IT such as Ocado and Orange and Betfair and companies like that. So we get the full range of companies, and you know, who take the product of our courses. And I should say that the students that come out of our courses are very much in high demand. We have close to 100% employment rate. And indeed, they attract, I think it's the second highest starting salaries of any graduates in the UK. It's only those graduates from the dismal science of economics that earn more from Cambridge and starting.
Well, that's a very good plug for the Department of Engineering and, of course, the Department of Computing. Also joining us is Dan Crowe, who's the CTO of the London-based startup success story, Songkick. Dan, welcome to the program. You've also worked with several other UK startups, as well as had quite a bit of experience in the US. How did you learn your skills? Because you've got an interesting background where you've been in academia, but now you've translated that into industry.
Sure. I started out many years ago doing a degree in computer science and a PhD in artificial intelligence, in fact, at the University of Leeds. And I started out intending to be an academic, and I actually ended up working on a European-funded project that required both industrial and academic partners for every institution. I ended up working with a small multimedia company, a little startup in Chipping Campden, and suddenly realized that actually what they were doing was much more exciting than what I was doing, and ended up going to work for them. And that's how I started out. I then went to the States, ended up working for many years in a bunch of startups in Silicon Valley, and have recently come back to the UK, and very excited to see that there's a very vibrant startup scene here in London particularly, and really, I think, things are changing dramatically. When I left in the mid-90s, there was virtually nothing happening in the UK. Now it's a completely different world, and it's really exciting to see how much things have changed and how much opportunity there is now here in London, and I'm delighted to be part of that.
Well, the focus of the Tech City Initiative is very much on East London, yeah. Around Silicon Roundabout, the Old Street Roundabout, as one part of the initiative. But you are involved with something called Silicon Milk Roundabout. What is that?
Silicon Milk Roundabout's a recruiting fair that we ran for the first time in May and are actually running again in about 3 weeks' time. And it's organized by Songkick. And what we're basically trying to do is get as many of the startups in particularly East London, but in the UK generally, together, and an opportunity for new graduates, for people who've been in industry for a while, to come and find out what the startup scene is like, talk to some of the exciting companies. We have 120 companies who are going to be there. We're going to be offering more than 400 jobs, and we'd love to get as many people coming along to that as possible, and really finding out that there's an amazing set of opportunities if you want to go and work in a startup right now in East London particularly, but in the UK generally.
Our final panelist, but certainly not least, is somebody who is representing the young people. Emma Mulqueeney, you are the founder of Young Rewired State, which is an organization aimed at getting people under the age of 18 into actually getting their fingers on keyboard and writing code. Emma, what is the work that you do with Rewired State?
Yes, it's sort of getting their hands on the keyboard. I find all of the kids in the UK who have taught themselves how to code, so they're sitting in their bedrooms, they already know how to code, but they've done that themselves, basically. It started in 2009 because I had run an event called National Hack the Government Day, which was about helping government open its data, basically, and then showing government what developers would do with this data once it was open. This was before data.gov.uk. And there were no kids. There were no kids at that event. So I thought, there must be kids out there who can code, and we need to get that next generation engaged. And so it was really hard to find them, but we found them. And then we've grown that every year. We go back out, we find them and bring them together, and the only thing that they have to do during the week, apart from code, is that they have to use one piece of government data in their app that they build. And then they do a show and tell, and prizes are awarded, and that's it. But they have all taught themselves how to code.
Isn't it shocking that they have to teach themselves? I mean, have they not had the opportunity at school or college to be taught how to code?
Well, not until this year. This year I started to have some that had come through that had learnt Scratch at school. And so they had, but not to the level that... And in fact, some of them were failing their exams because they were writing and programming languages that their teachers couldn't understand, therefore fail.
I'd love to find out a little bit more about how you find these, these young kids in their bedrooms with their PCs. But what's interesting, and actually drawing, David, on your question, it seems as if there was a real culture maybe coming from the 80s, based on the move of BBC Micro in particular in this country to get kids with their hands on keyboards and playing around. And certainly out of that, we saw a really an innovative and thriving computer games industry in the mid-90s, which created a very interesting platform here. And Jeff, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, you know, the possibilities now.
One of the things that we find extremely surprising is that nearly over half of the students that we now admit to, and that's about 120 students a year, to do computing degrees, don't have any previous programming experience. So they're using IT as an appliance, you know, as David was saying. They don't actually understand what's underlying it, and they don't really understand the intellectual excitement behind computing science. And I think what we try to convey in the degrees, and I think what the schools should be conveying, is exactly this challenge, this rigor, this intellectual excitement in computing science, which I don't think is there in the syllabuses that we have today.
Well, in August, Eric Schmidt, who's a Google exec chair, lambasted the UK's system. He said he was, and I quote, flabbergasted to learn that today computer science isn't even taught as standard in UK schools. Your IT curriculum focuses on teaching how to use the software, but gives no insight into how it's made. And David Willetts, have we thrown away our great computer heritage?
I don't think it's permanently thrown away, but this is absolutely the problem we've all been agreeing. For some reason, and I don't fully understand quite what went wrong, having in the 80s really been rather good at encouraging kids into writing code, the curriculum drifted towards this kind of consumer model. And in fact, worse than that, a consumer model which is so far behind the actual experience of teenagers that the GCSE course they found it just completely mind-numbingly boring. So there's also evidence that not many kids wanted to do the IT GCSE, and certainly they didn't then go on to A-level. But now, and influenced by, not least by the industry, drawing attention to this problem, we have been trying over the past year to turn it around. And that's what this first experiment behind the screen is all about, and I hope it can go a lot further. And the industry is also chipping in by developing teaching aids that help teenagers first get a sense of the excitement of writing code and generating software themselves. Google, for example, at chipping in, and many other players as well, IBM. So I think we can turn it around. It's not a permanent loss, but it is something that's gone wrong, and we're tackling it.
What can be achieved, though? I'd like to sort of find out a bit more about this initiative. What types of things will be taught? How long will it take? At what point in the schooling curriculum will it happen?
At the moment, it's a pilot, and it's happening in about 20 schools, volunteers. It's starting about now, and it's going to run through into the summer. And the aim is to start with a new type of GCSE that would be on the creative side. Then they'll move on from that to an A-level. And also at the university level, what I hope we'll do is, again, distinguish between computer science, which is the generating of a product, and an IT. Some of the courses don't provide this kind of training in generating product. And what I'm working at with the industry as well is getting them to kite mark the courses that really do provide you with the training in writing code and generating product, so that a student that wants to go to study this at university can see the ones that are going to provide them a route into that kind of employment, and the courses that, as they're designed at the moment, don't provide that.
Well, indeed, there are some pretty depressing figures. The Joint Council for Qualifications documents the fall in ICT studies at 33% fall in ICT at GCSE levels between 2006 and 2009, 33% fall in A-level ICT between 2003 and 2009, and a 57% fall in A-level computing between 2001 and 2009. Emma, this suggests that ICT shouldn't necessarily be embedded in the curriculum. Is it better to perhaps devolve this to the community and out to industry?
I don't think so. I think that it does definitely need to be a part of the curriculum. I think that we need to do something about it earlier. I do think that year 8 is too late. I think especially girls, we lose the girls in about year 5. And as they go, we can see that as soon as they hit teenagedom, it then becomes deeply uncool, and especially if you're having to do extra homework, in order to, you know, be good enough to kind of go and do anything with programming, which is geeky in itself. So no girl's going to kind of risk that. So I think we need to bring it in earlier. But it will compound the problem if we make it something that's outside of the curriculum totally, because, again, it's doing extra homework, it's programming, it's, you know, it's already got this image that we need to change.
I'd like to just briefly, before we move on, but actually question a basic assumption that we're making here, which is that it's important that people learn to code.
Can I take that point? I mean, if you look at our admissions website, it has divides the categories of A-levels into three categories, you know, one, two, and three of, you know, desirability. You know, category one's essential, A-level maths. Category two is desirable, very highly desirable, further maths. And category three lists a wide range of A-levels, you know, ancient languages, English, maths, physics and chemistry, and computing. So that's the importance that we give to it as a basis for studying computing science as a rigorous, intellectually challenging subject, and to train those engineers who are going to build the digital economy. But that's one side of it. Now, the other side of it is that, you know, computational thinking is a general skill. It's applicable to many elements of science in the training of our kids today. It's not only programming. It's the ability to abstract, to think about problems at multiple levels that's important that we teach our kids. And the excitement in building information technology should also be there, as well as the excitement of using it. Because, you know, if we're only users of it, we're not going to contribute to the overall digital economy.
Looking at the Behind the Screen initiative, David, there have been some criticisms, because maybe you can clarify this for me. People are being learned to use software that helps them to code as opposed to actually writing the languages themselves. Can you respond to that? What details can you give me on that?
Well, I mean, at the moment it is GCSE level that's being piloted. They have not yet moved on to A level. And you're right, at the moment it's Google and others are helping the project in the way you describe. But we'll see how it plays out. We'll see what can be expected of kids for the GCSE. And to some extent there is a trade-off here as to how ambitious and demanding you make it as against how widespread you want the course to be. And this is a dilemma all across the sciences. And we'll see how far teenagers can be pushed as the pilot develops.
There are other initiatives that are attempting to do exactly what it is that you announced. And, in fact, Dr. Bill Mitchell, who's the director of the BCS, which is the Academy of Computing, is also here today. And, Bill, I wanted to just reach out to you to get a kind of context here. What is the context in which the Behind the Screen is operating? What are some of the other grassroots organizations doing?
I think the Behind the Screen project actually is a marvellous concept, and the aspiration there is absolutely first class. You do have to, though, look at a bit of a historical context there. I mean, in the past, if you look around the diploma, there were lots and lots of employer engagement around the various different diplomas. You know, for the IT diploma, there were 600 employers involved in actually putting that together. But it was commonly felt that the diplomas actually didn't quite work out. So you do need to ensure that when you're putting together a new qualification, you do engage with all the key stakeholders. So, for example, computing at school is a volunteer group. It's about 800 strong, 85% of school teachers, but it's also got examining board people on there, professionals on there, members of Google, Microsoft. They've actually put together a curriculum that they developed over the last couple of years. So if you don't look at the kind of work that's already there and being put together by the community and the various different stakeholders, there are going to be issues with actually implementing it on the ground, I think. And I mustn't forget the other groups, you know, CS for Fun at Queen Mary. And at the moment there is also a study going on with the Royal Society, which is looking at precisely these issues of how you actually do deliver computing in schools and what is the right kind of computing that you should deliver there. So for me, I think getting engagement with all the different groups that are working on that, a lot of whom have already produced really top quality material, and it's freely available, it's not as if they're, you know, trying to commercialise it, I think that is actually quite key to getting something that's going to be successful, that will get buy-in and that will actually scale across the entire school community.
Emma, you mentioned before that you don't feel that this should be devolved to community groups to industry. What do you think the role of industry should be in inspiring kids to actually pick these things up?
Probably relevance. Certainly if you've got industry involved and wanting to help, and no one's yet mentioned Mozilla, and Mozilla are doing some interesting things in this space as well. And I think that if industry can come into schools and help make it relevant and inspire these kids and show them what they can do, and also be beaten by them. I mean, the beauty of what I see when you actually have these ones that can program, that have taught themselves, and then when they show what they've done back to grown-up industry people who are kind of creating this stuff, they are floored by it. And actually, you know, that's the genius. We want these people to be, you know, to be populating Tech City and to be embarrassing everybody, basically, with their awesome skills. So, but they do need that inspiration and to be shown that this is a future and it's a valuable future and that there's money in it as well, because, you know.
And look, there's an issue about how much should be compulsory. And in general, I don't like sort of forcing teenagers to do things. I think it's, by and large, you're on to a lose if you do that. And I think the challenge is for us to make it sufficiently relevant and appealing, including the intellectual excitement of computational science, that it takes off that way. But down the track, we can absolutely signal that it's both worthwhile in its own right, that it leads you to good employment, and there are some really exciting challenges there. Going beyond education, George Osborne and I announced only last week £145 million for e-infrastructure, which is not just for the hardware of high-performance computing, it's also to write some of the software you need for parallel computing, which is one of the big challenges of the future. If you're going to have these, if you're going to use your IT in computing power in parallel, existing conventional software doesn't enable you to use that very well. We need to be skilled at writing that. So there are some really exciting challenges going right out into the future. Stringle that together, and I think you'll find teenagers wanting to study it.
The problem, though, David, is that there are cuts, and everybody is aware that we're going to have to face these cuts. How will you encourage teachers and schools to make a big change in the curriculum? How will you encourage people to upskill? How will you be able to do all of this in an age of austerity? Because ultimately, what you're proposing means investment in people, in retraining, in time.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. It is an age of austerity. Of course, we have actually tried to protect in real terms the education budget. I know there are always going to be pressures and people won't be able to do everything they want, but we've done our best in tough times.
I think actually one of the things that for me is missing, look, Britain invented the computer. Most of the intellectual foundations for modern computing were laid by a guy called Alan Turing, who's one of my personal heroes. But we don't talk about that in the broader culture. I looked at someone like Brian Cox, who's done an extraordinary job of evangelising much of science. We need somebody who can do the same for British computing and really explain to the broad audience not just what computing can do, but just how exciting it can be to be involved in that. And it's such a creative process. People, you know, the common view is of people sitting away in a darkened room and you know, it's like this boring thing. It's not. It's the most creative thing you can do. It's purely of the mind. And if we could find a way of exciting young people to that notion, I don't think that needs to be particularly expensive. And if then the opportunity is there for people to do, you know, the behind the screens and go on and you know, take advantage of Imperial's amazing education, then I think that alone would actually help us a great deal.
Moving forward, the next issue in this debate is how the UK's ICT curriculum at schools and higher education level can ensure, after we've convinced them that they should explore these options at GCSE or other levels, that the people who are being trained actually have the skills to produce the workforce. Dan, I'd like to turn to you here as our representative at the coalface. What does industry see as important in the next few years?
It's a pretty diverse collection. I represent specifically startups right now. We see enormous opportunity. Just in the last 3 years, we've gone from 70 startups in the East London area to more than 500. That represents thousands of well-paid, extremely interesting jobs, and we're just starting out. We're starting to see the venture capital community come in strongly behind this. And so, you know, we are looking for the best and the brightest. We're mainly looking for graduates in computer science. And I think that if we can find those people, and particularly if we can persuade them that going off and working in, you know, the city and in finance is not necessarily the most exciting opportunity they have before them, but there are other ways that they can go, we'd love to see that. And I think right now, I mean, just talking about Songkick, my company, as an example, we can't find enough good people. We just recently hired a guy from Silicon Valley because we couldn't find good people here in the UK.
But what are the specific skills that you're looking for that you had to hire from Silicon Valley that you didn't get in the UK?
I'm not interested in specific skills. I'm interested in mindsets. One of the things that we find really challenging in hiring is not people who have a particular programming language or a particular set of you know, environments or skills that they have, but people who combine that with an entrepreneurial mindset. One of the things that's extraordinary about Silicon Valley is how amazingly entrepreneurial the environment is there. And here in the UK, I don't think we're quite there yet. You know, we love extremely smart people, but we also like people who are interested in creating businesses, creating value, and creating products that are going to move the whole world forward. So, you know, what we look for are people who absolutely have the technical skills, but also have that desire to change the world. And being able to find that combination can be challenging.
And incidentally, in terms of role models, you're right about Alan Turing. But Tim Berners-Lee did change the world.
Sure.
And that was a British scientist at CERN, and he has changed the world in a way very few people did in the 20th century.
So given this conversation that we're having here, Jeff, how relevant are university courses in computing to the workplace if all we really want is a bit of chutzpah?
Well, we listen exactly to what the employers that we talk to, you know, say, and, you know, and what they want is exactly as Dan said. It's they want people who are not focused on specific technology but who are adaptable, who are, you know, numerically competent and can lead to different solutions. They also, actually, we get a very strong message from them, is that they want students to have more soft skills, the ability to work in teams, the ability to communicate, the ability to present. Now, this agenda about giving them more entrepreneurial skills, I think, is a real one. The output of universities are twofold. We produce research, we produce intellectual property, and we produce trained staff. And giving those trained staff, you know, the background and the support, you know, to start up businesses, to get involved in entrepreneurial activities, is something we should be doing more of. And it's what we're getting engaged in. For example, during the summer, we had Seed Camp here, which a lot of our students engaged in, which was very exciting for them. We have the Business School, which is a world-leading center in, you know, innovation and so on. So we have got the ability to do that. We just don't put it together as much as perhaps we should do. And I think universities in general are devoting more effort to, you know, looking at what their students can do as well as what their staff do. And that's quite exciting for us.
So, Emma, on the ground, when you find these kids who are burrowed away in their bedrooms coding, do they have entrepreneurial spirit? Do
yes,
they have chutzpah? Do they, I mean,
yes,
and how
do
you then translate that into people who then go into industry?
Going back to the, we can't find the kids, that's because they're going to the States. And, what I found, and I've been quite surprised by, is that British industry are not tearing my hands off to get their hands on these kids. Silicon Valley is. I cannot get anybody in the UK, even if I say I'm finding our brightest kids that can program, don't you want them? And no one seems to want them, but Silicon Valley are just like, yes, we want them. We want them out here. We want them at Carnegie Mellon. My top 10 that I can think of are all headed out to the States. So it's not that they're not here. It's just that industry hasn't embraced them and hasn't said, come here, we want you, we want your skills here. They're more interested in the code monkey side of things. You know, come in and, you know, build this thing for me that we've thought of in the boardroom that we just want you to build. Please go build.
So, David Willetts, are the universities in the UK equipped to create these kinds of non-code monkey entrepreneurs? Perhaps with a little bit of monkeyness, but, you know, mostly entrepreneurial.
what needs to change at university? The truth is we can always do better. But what we've just heard from Emma was depressing, and that wasn't about universities. That was about the ultimate demand from businesses seeing what the opportunity was. And as Emma was talking, I was so shocked by that. I was thinking, what the hell do we do next? Right, I think what I'm going to next time I have a meeting of the group I chair on high performance computing and e-infrastructure, which is going to have to ensure that this $150 million investment we've made is spent effectively with matching, I hope, investment from the private sector. I think we'd better get Emma along. We better, because it's terrible. We shouldn't be wasting this talent. Of course, it's a free world. People should be able to travel to the US, but there should be opportunities for them, and we should bloody well make sure we're not wasting these people. Yeah.
So, Jeff, what needs to be refined actually practically within the university system to produce people who are relevant to industry and to produce an industry that recognises the university system as relevant for their needs?
Well, I mean, if you look at the sort of supply and demand, I mean, the demand for the graduates of our, I mean, we can't produce enough graduates industry want. So how do we get enough people going into the system? And the problem relies really on the ability to get students who are numerate. In other words, those with A-level mathematics at the level we require, which is now A-star level, in fact, those that, that do well in our courses. And actually, we're not producing enough students studying those subjects to put into the system. So I think there's a supply problem as well.
We've got a couple of questions from the audience. The first is for Jeff. What proportion of highly paid Imperial College students go into the entrepreneurial side of industry and what into banks? Given the disparity in the price bracket.
I don't have exact that figure. I know that 40% of them do go into the financial sector, but that means that the majority of them don't, which is something we grasp hold of. So at least, nearly half of them do go into the IT sector, you know, IT and communications. But, clearly in London, the financial sector is a pool and it's money that works.
And that was a question via Twitter from Ashley Brown. And then we've got another question from the panel from Simon Overell. Very interesting question, actually. Do we need to teach what the internet is and how content is created, as well as how code is created? And I'll send this one to you, Dan. Mm.
I'm not sure that we do. By and large, people get that now. It's such an integral part of our lives. Do we need to teach people to think about what the opportunities that technology opens up for them? I think perhaps yes, we do. I think it's easy to think about it as just this thing that happens. It's just there, and you kind of let it fade into the background. And I do think that, as somebody from a web technology company, I do think that we need to get people understanding that there is something. There's magic that you can create there. So maybe what we really need to talk to people about is the opportunity that there is and the set of things that you can accomplish with this technology base more than about the thing itself.
Emma, what do you think about this?
I actually disagree. there's a book called Program or Be Programmed by Douglas Rushkoff. And in it, he talks about having to properly understand the internet, because basically, otherwise, Google is going to be your brain. You know, if you write into Google a question and Google supplies you with an answer, most 9 times out of 10 people will believe that to be true. Now, all that's doing is Google's algorithm is asking its own interpretation of your question of its data that it's got there and serving up what it thinks is the response. So if you are naive about that and about the internet, then I think you are risking lobotomizing the nation. So I think it's quite important that you do, and not just computer scientists. I think, you know, generally speaking, people need to understand this. He describes it like understanding programming and not understanding programming being the difference between the driver and the passenger. And most people think that the difference is between being the driver and the mechanic, and that's not true. But if you think of yourself as the passenger in life, I don't think anybody would choose to be that.
An interesting distinction there between the various literacies and the new literacy that we now have to come to terms with. We have been speaking about the US and we have been speaking about Silicon Valley, and now I'd like to briefly move over to that. There has been much made about the relationship between Stanford University and the success of startups in the Bay Area, primarily in Silicon Valley. Jeff McGee, what is the link between academia and Silicon Valley?
One of the main factors, I think, was the fact that there were so many trained PhDs in that area. I mean, Stanford clearly is a centre of excellence, academic excellence, and we have that here in London. We have it at Oxford, we have it at Cambridge. But I think that what was required was a concentration, and part of the stimulus for that was this huge bunch of really bright people that was trained by Stanford. We haven't been able to replicate that in exactly the same way. And I think that in Tech City, we have that opportunity. to get these PhD students, these postdocs, at that level, when they're really technically competent and they've got ideas and they've been exposed to quite a large scientific background, to get them engaged in it. And I think if we can do that, it would be a lever.
But is it not also a notion of the culture in the US, this, in many ways, Dan, as you were talking about, this entrepreneurial culture in which, as far as I'm aware, there is a celebration in many ways of the ownership of patents that come through universities. There's a money spinning opportunity, which in many ways in this country is not encouraged from within the ivory tower.
There's a deep, deep cultural difference, and we're beginning to change it, but I think we still have a long way to go. I remember very clearly the first time I went out to Silicon Valley in the mid-90s. Certainly then it was like night and day. In Britain there's this kind of general cultural feeling that the one thing that you must avoid at all costs is failure. It doesn't matter if you're mediocre, as long as you don't actually fail, you can get by in life. If you go to California, they don't take you seriously unless you've blown up at least two companies. Failure is seen as a mark of somebody who actually has tried to do something. You're only actually valued and you are encouraged to think about risk. Risk is something that they actually, the culture actually encourages. And that is there are many reasons why Silicon Valley happened, but that's one of the key ones.
How can we encourage people to fail more?
First of all, culture does not float independently. Saying there's a cultural difference isn't really an explanation at all. The crucial point is, I love the example, you've got to blow up a couple of companies. The whole point is that in a cluster, that is not a particularly risky thing. The whole point about a cluster, I think the best definition is, it is a low-risk environment for high-risk activities. As soon as you know that if you've blown up one company, it doesn't matter because you can still set up another company. In other words, you have changed the amount of risk involved in the transaction. So it's not that people have to be more courageous. You change an environment where the risks are less. And the secret of California, it's a far less risky environment than people imagine. There is a large amount of public support. They are much better than us at linking original support through grants for research through to the National Institute of Health and the Science Foundation, providing continuing support. Then there's DARPA and there's MOD, Department of Defense contracts. There's quite a lot of public support. The Californian Supreme Court struck down the non-compete clauses in labor contracts in California. So if you can take your intellectual capital from one business to another business and immediately use it. So the paradox is, it's not that they are superhumanly more risk-taking than we are. They've created a cluster which has lowered the risks of engaging in these types of activities. And that, at that point, rational public policy steps in. And we can try to do some of that in the UK. We can ensure there's much greater continuity between the Research Council funding, what the Technology Strategy Board does, smart public procurement of innovative products. We can, when you support clusters, you can in turn mean that if your business in Tech City doesn't work out, you can turn up the Tech Hub and you'll probably get rehired within a week and another. So we can do things that change the environment rather than being in awe of an American willingness to take risk.
I think there absolutely are things we can do. And I mean, it is very interesting that Silicon, if you go back into the sort of prehistory of Silicon Valley, it's absolutely as much founded on the American military machine as it is on Stanford. Yeah. I think those are both key parts of why did it happen in Silicon Valley? That and the sunshine. But I mean, I actually do genuinely think there's a cultural difference. One of the things that's been very interesting for me personally is, I mean, back in the mid-90s, I think the cultural differences were much more stark than they are now. I think we are becoming more entrepreneurial and more risk-taking as a nation, and I think that's a good thing and we should encourage it, and we should celebrate the fact that I think we're moving in the right direction there. So I certainly agree with you that I don't think that cultural difference is by any means the only reason. I think there's plenty of things that the government and industry and academia can do to help encourage and foster what's happening in East London and elsewhere. But I don't think it's a zero effect either.
I'd like to open it out to questions. We do have some in from Twitter, and I'll definitely try and ask them if we don't hear from you in the audience. So first, I'd like to go back here.
Thank you. My name is Jonathan Haskell from Imperial College. I'm very curious to hear about the situation in schools and where the ICT teaching seems to have gone so badly wrong, particularly in light of the fact that, if I understand correctly from what was being said earlier, we used to be rather good at it. I can understand if we were always awful at it, but the fact that we used to be rather good at it and it's gone wrong. So I was interested in that. But the second thing I wanted to ask, possibly to Jeff McGee, is to what extent is the problem from schools a maths problem rather than a computer problem? Because you said a lot of times, Jeff, I think, that the kind of students you were looking for were very mathematically literate. Mm-hmm. Is it the case that schools are still failing to produce enough maths graduates, and therefore even if we pushed on the computer margin, that might help, but that might not do the full job?
So your question in two parts. The first part, I think, when we were very good at it, was the BBC Micro generation and the excitement of the BBC Micro and when it really did engage the schools. And I think we've lost a lot of that. The second point is that actually for our degrees, ICT or computing is not an important A level. It's one we don't emphasise and it's one we don't particularly recommend them to take because of the way the state it's in at the moment, perhaps. However, we do want them to be excited about it. We want them to be interested in the subject, so it needs to be part of the syllabus. But what we do require is mathematics, and we are not getting enough students with the right qualifications in mathematics.
David Willetts, I'd like to just briefly extend this. And what's interesting is that we have heard stories again and again this evening about a common technology that came into a school system that inspired people, with the BBC Micro in particular. Now, as we mentioned, we're almost at a ubiquitous, invisible technology with the internet. What types of technologies can government come into partnership with the school system, with media, with whomever is providing, in order to create this inspiration again?
Well, I think you, as I said earlier, I think if you look at what is being trialled, and it does involve IBM, Google, I think Facebook are involved as well, it is an attempt to get contemporary technologies into schools. As to what went wrong, and learning the lessons from what went wrong, I agree that the BBC Micro was excellent. What went wrong was, my understanding, is that but some kids just found themselves being taught Fortran, and they emerged with kind of ancient code skills and no wider understanding, and they had been trained in an ancient technology and emerge and find that the world has moved on. So the other thing you can do is you can kind of ossify people by giving them a training that is so narrowly focused on today's knowledge set that you miss out. And we mustn't repeat the Fortran mistake. Mm.
Yes, hello, my name is Annabelle Gower, and I'm an assistant professor here of strategy and innovation at the Business School at Imperial College. Thank you for this great debate. I had a question. Aren't we over-focusing on computer skills? Because on the one hand, I heard all of you say we need to create value in this new digital economy, and then we somehow magically zoomed in, we should, you know, teach kids to program. I would like to say that there are some fundamental skills that our citizens of tomorrow need to learn, and which currently you need to get an MBA at a place like Imperial to have access to, such as what are the fundamentals of digital business? What are the fundamentals of, from an economics perspective and from a management perspective, of creating value and capturing value in this economy? And I would like to, you know, not just plug for Imperial, but just to appeal to the fact that these are real skills that may not be, that high school may not be the appropriate level to teach at, but to respond to the quandary of, you know, multidisciplinary. We have to recognize that people live a very long time and they don't have to learn everything at the same time in their lives.
I think the next stage of the growth of the digital economy in the UK is going to be absolutely driven by people with extraordinary technical skills. But it's also, as you say, going to be driven by people who have that ability to understand business and transform, take the output of those skills and transform them into successful businesses. And ideally, you want people who can embody both of those in the same head.
And can I just add one specific practical thing that governments can do, is that we are backing the idea that there should be a student entrepreneur society at every university. Yeah. So whatever you're studying, you should have the opportunity of joining a local group at your own university where you can explore that.
That's incredibly important. I think that is a real step forward.
How, though, do you create that culture is the question.
But it's chicken and egg. If you don't try, you'll never get it.
I'm afraid we really do only have time for one more question. And, yeah?
My name is Simon Overell. I'm from a startup which will be at Milk Roundabout with Dan called Spider.io. My question is directed to Emma and Jeff. How young should you start teaching computer science in schools, and what form should it take when it's first introduced to primary school students?
My daughter is in year five. She's nine. And her maths is now just strong enough for her to be able to understand Java and to begin to start coding. So she doesn't get taught in school, but I use a lot of the software like Code Academy and all that, Tribeby, and all those things that are out there, and there's an awful lot of resource, and people are kind of bringing this stuff together. And her maths is strong enough just about for her to do this, but she also, you know, she is a gamer, she plays games, she knows how to break Sims and put in Rosebud and get extra money. So there's lots of kind of different ways that I can kind of teach her programming that's not kind of strictly what she would learn in school. But you can teach Scratch at that age very easy. But I think at year five, that's when the maths is strong enough. And that's when you've still got the girls. And we've got to, as well, bring the girls through this thing.
It's been like she's on a fast track to Imperial, I'd say.
And Jeff, would you like to respond to the question as well?
I completely agree with the challenge is getting more female students into this discipline. Over the years, we've got worse rather than better, which I think is disgraceful. However, you know, in terms of when you introduce computing science to students, there is a level at which children develop the ability to abstract. And if you try and do it before that, I think you're in difficulty, because one of the key skills involved in building complex systems is abstraction. So, and you know, you referred to some of the levels at which you can do that, and so to me that's key. The other thing is that if you introduce computing science at the rather tedious level of, you know, producing levels of instructions to get a machine to do something, exciting though it may be, eventually becomes boring unless you can find something more interesting to do with it. So I think it is a challenge to introduce it at the right level so that you don't demotivate students later on when they either think that it's too simple. So getting it right, I think, is quite a challenge.
Finally, David Willetts, taking all of this into consideration, what is the government's priority for the future? Is it skills for digital media? Is it research and development and the cross-disciplinary element? Is it getting kids when they're young and inspiring them? Is it putting particular technologies into schools? Is it engineering? What is the government's priority? I need one, please.
They all sound pretty good to me. But our priority is to get a proper flow through from primary, secondary, on into college and university, people with the ability to contribute to this crucial part, not just of the economy, but for society in the future. And it involves linking up what happens at GCSEs, A-levels, university courses and beyond into research. And we're working across government doing it. And if you look at and I think we're beginning to make some progress because we believe in it. And you can see in Tech City the sheer excitement in the enterprise when you get it right.
I'm afraid that is all we have time for this evening. I'd like to thank our panelists very much, Minister David Willetts, Professor Jeff McGee, Dan Crow, and Emma Mulcini. Now, we have three more special Tech Weekly Tech City talks in the series, so do keep your eyes on guardian.co.uk/techweekly for more information. I'm Alex Krotowski, and the producer was Scott Cawley. Thank you very much to our audience here in the room and to our panel.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.